for the sake of the recording, session number two on Old Testament justice, and the title that we've given to today's presentation is Must the Christian Obey the Law? It's a pleasure to continue this with you, and I'd like to begin with a quotation from the book of Deuteronomy, which I think puts the question to us, and it's one that I'd like to pursue, and we'll be about this for the balance of the week, actually. Deuteronomy chapter 10, verses 12 following. Now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? But to fear the Lord God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments and the statutes of the Lord which I command you this day for your good. The question that might be asked, is that particular statement in Deuteronomy still applicable to the Christian? I'm going to say yes. And we're going to talk about it. Now, we're going to deal today a lot more with law in a more general sense, and I won't pick out too many matters relative to specific issues of justice, but in the next couple of days, we're going to be very concerned about the way in which these materials work with issues relating to justice, particularly their treatment of the poor. And it's important that we be clear on law before we begin to talk about some of the particulars that we find therein. As I make my way out and about in the church these days, I find that there is a question that seems to be as prominent as any question is: what does it mean to be a Christian in today's world? Or what shape should the life of faith take? When all is said and done, with regard to what God has done for me in and through Jesus Christ, what am I now to do in all the ins and outs of my daily life? Or to use the language of the preacher, you've all been washed in the blood of the Lamb, and the response might be, okay, so what? I sometimes wonder if the appeal of people like Bill Gothard and Basic Youth Conflicts, or the books of Larry Christensen and others, aren't related to a real problem here. They meet a need relating to questions that people have with regard to Christian responsibility and the shape which Christian life ought to take. They may not be handling the questions like we might want to handle them, but are they not addressing a need that should be addressed much more directly by good Lutherans, so that Lutheran people don't have to go outside of their congregations to hear the word about what Christian responsibility in the life of the world is all about? People compensate for what they lack in crazy ways. Are we so afraid of legalism that we cease to care about what it means to be obedient? How often do you hear the word obedient in sermons or in the teaching of the church? I sometimes wonder whether we've overreacted to the legalistic piety of our forebears. We haven't recognized the truth that underlies that piety, and I think we've often neglected our responsibility as far as the Christian living of Christian life is concerned. I think that all too often we've thought that what we really need to be about is to get people right with God, and that everything else will take care of itself, thank you. Or we've so stressed that God does everything in the Christian life that the obedience of the Christian has turned out to be so passive that it's finally nothing other than the obedience of God, which is really a docetic view of the Christian life. Why does the word obedience so often seem to be a dirty word? The fact that so many of the legal materials in the books of Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, as we'll be seeing particularly tomorrow and some the next day, so many of these materials have to do with issues of justice. Justice for the down and out, the mistreated, the poor, suggests to me that there may be some more subtle but very powerful reasons why we've ignored those materials. Yesterday, the question was raised about the ignoring of certain psalms. The fact that in the Lutheran Book of Worship, 28 psalms have been omitted, and almost all of them have to do with psalms which are cries of the oppressed. Have we, for comparable reasons, ignored many of the legal materials because of the fact that the justice issue is put in such straightforward ways there to us all? We much prefer the simple word love and kind of leave the word open-ended without particularizing it. We can define that word according to our own tastes, and we can escape from all kinds of responsibility. As we tried to indicate some yesterday, most people think that the word law, think of the word law primarily in negative terms. It's that which restrains, it's that which keeps us doing what we really would like to do, and I think we need to recapture some of the positive force of this word as it is used in these texts. Law is fundamentally concerned with the well-being of people. Law is given by God for people's best interests. Law is concerned for preserving life. Law is concerned to instruct us in the faith, to help us develop maturity, to help develop wisdom. We indicated the basic definition of Torah or law in the Old Testament is instruction in the life of faith, or instruction for the life of faith. Now, I think that the concern with this concern to preserve life, to contribute to the well-being of people, I wonder how often we have distorted certain laws in order to make them say something other than what they were originally intended to say, so that we can give them a negative cast or more than a positive cast. Commonly, I think, to escape from the implications that many of them have for daily life. The third commandment: remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. What does that commandment mean? What would you say? What's immediately off the top of your head? What does that? What?
Worship.
Worship. What else?
Rest.
Don't do the wash.
Don't do the wash. Okay.
Change of pace. Difference.
Change of pace or difference. Okay.
Set aside.
Something set aside. Okay.
Go to church.
Go to church. Well, it's interesting to me to take a look at that. Let me take a look at that Sabbath commandment with you for just a moment. You realize that nowhere in the Old Testament are people ever said to worship on the Sabbath day? No. Begins to appear in intertestamental times, the period between the Testaments, and you do find some worshiping on the Sabbath in the New Testament. Jesus goes, for example, in Luke 4, as in states in Luke 4, as his custom was. But as far as we can determine, there's no Old Testament reference. Nowhere is it said that the Sabbath day is for worship services. Nowhere is it said that God wants the Sabbath so that God can be worshipped. There are very few late passages which speak of certain Sabbath sacrifices being offered, but there's never any indication that any one of those sacrifices is given in the presence of people. All the indications are that they're just regular priestly functions in the texts are very few and they're late. Now listen to some of the basic Sabbath texts. What is their concern? Go back to Exodus 20. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. What does it mean to keep it holy? It simply means to set it aside. It doesn't have anything to do with worship. One of my favorite texts with regard to holiness is in the last chapter of Zechariah, where in the days to come talks about horses' bells being holy. I love that one. Horses' bells and a whole variety of other quite incidental things in everyday life are holy. It doesn't have to be specifically religious, quote unquote, for it to be holy. It's to be set aside for a specific purpose, which is in tune with the intentions of God. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. The seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God, and in it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, or your manservant, or your maidservant, or your cattle, your cows, okay? Or the sojourner. And nowadays, whenever you come across the word sojourner in the text, the only way to really get the full impact of the word sojourner, we'll talk about this a little bit more tomorrow, is to substitute the word refugee. Exactly what these people were, they're refugees. As they say, we'll talk more about that tomorrow. Or the refugee who is within your gates. Why in the world do you think that in that commandment, we don't have the kids memorize them anymore, and just remember the Sabbath day to keep holy. Why is it that you got the manservant and the maidservant and you got the refugees all listed separately? Unless there was a special concern that those people were somehow not getting the benefits of the Sabbath. Why? For in 6 days the Lord your God made heaven and earth, the sea and all that's in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the seventh day. Hallowed it. Listen to Exodus 23:12. 6 days you shall do your work, but on the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your ass, you get the donkeys in here too, may have rest, and the son of your bondmaid, and the alien, or the refugee again, may be refreshed. Or listen to Exodus 34:21. 6 days you shall work, but on the seventh day you shall rest, in plowing time and in harvest, those especially busy times, in plowing time and in harvest, you shall rest even then. And then it's made especially clear in the Deuteronomic formulation of this commandment, Deuteronomy 5:12. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. The seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work. You, or your son, or your daughter, or your manservant, or your maidservant, or your ox, or your ass, or any of your cattle, or the refugee that is within your gates, that your manservant, here's the little extra clause, that your manservant and your maidservant may rest as well as you. Why here? Here it doesn't refer back to the creation account. Here it says, you shall remember that you were a slave or a servant in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. What's the force of all those Sabbath texts? They don't have anything to do with worship. The concern of all those Sabbath texts is humanitarian. Humanitarian, so that people like the servants and the animals and the refugees and all might rest. The listing out of the person suggests that there was a problem in the community, that certain persons were resting like the landowners and making others do work. The emphasis in the third commandment, at least originally, and as far as we can tell throughout the whole Old Testament, had nothing to do with going to church, at least directly. Indirectly, one might talk about some ways in which one rests, but fundamentally a question of justice, not a question of worship. The day is to be set aside so that all the members of the community, not just a few, may rest and be refreshed. Now, the two, depending upon Exodus or Deuteronomy, they're rooted in two different, rooted in Exodus and Deuteronomy. Because you were slaves and God gave you rest in the land, well, then you ought to be attentive to all of those who continue to be less fortunate. In the creation, in the Exodus text, rooted in creation, it makes it universalized. It's applicable to all. The Sabbath law is not something especially for Israel. I mean, only for Israel. It's especially for Israel, but not only for Israel. It's one way in which all persons can be in tune with the creation as God intended it to be. It's interesting, I think. Israel did not borrow the Sabbath, as far as we know. Israel did not borrow the Sabbath no rest notion from any surrounding culture. There's some kind of continuities here, but there's nothing like it, really. I find it interesting how pervasive this has become in the world today, well outside of the Jewish and Christian communities. Many such persons will argue for a day off. They may not be the same day, but a day at least. Jesus finally, I think, picks up on this in the right way. The Sabbath was made for people. Sabbath was made for people, not people for the Sabbath. And so Jesus heals on the Sabbath day. He performs acts of mercy on the Sabbath, claiming in effect that that's precisely what the Sabbath is for. Sabbath is for people and not for God, except for God insofar as it's for people. Now, I find that intriguing, an intriguing example of how often we can take such familiar materials and twist them in such a way that their basic force is diminished or forgotten altogether. And I wonder sometimes whether or not the fact that the less fortunate in our midst are given such prominent attention in that particular legal material, that that's the reason we forget about it and set it aside. You know, one of the things that we need to keep in mind here, I think, is that we often forget. I think part of the problem with the small catechism, by the way, in lifting out the Ten Commandments, is that the Ten Commandments tend to get isolated, and they become almost a code when they're isolated. But in the original text, the commandments are not presented as code. The commandments and other legal materials are interwoven with a story. And so you get the Exodus materials and the coming out of Egypt, and then you move into the Sinai material and giving the law, then you're back into the wilderness, and then you're back into some more legal material, and then you're back into more narrative. And so the legal material is all bound up and intermixed with story. Story of God's fundamental deliverance, redemption of his people. And so the primary context for the legal material is liberation. It's liberation. It's redemption. I think that's very important, that the laws not stand independent of the story of God's promise and God's redemptive activity on behalf of Israel. They're a part of the story of God's goodness. Goodness, you say? Well, maybe one of the things you could ways you could look at this would be to say, would God want, or I'll flip it into the human situation, would you give your child, send your child out on an especially dark night in a strange place without flashlight? Would you send your child out into these woods without a map and without a path in sight? That's not freedom. That's hell of some kind. The law, in this context for Israel, is something like that flashlight and that path. God's concern not to leave the people who have been redeemed without some indication of what it means to live as a child of God. God's concern that his children not be left without direction. Without some indication of the way in which they are to walk as people of God. So the law then is never abstracted from this story. God's goodness and bound up as a law code separate from the story. Law, story, are always understood in relationship to one another. So Let me repeat what I did yesterday. At the heart of, there's no misunderstanding here. The heart of Israel's faith is God's saving activity on behalf of the people. Okay? Seen most supremely in the deliverance from the Exodus, and the Exodus and surrounding events. This was the constitutive event for Israel. This is what made them the people of God. Israel was redeemed from bondage, made a people. The law, then, is given to a redeemed people. The law in the Old Testament is never a means by which people come into relationship with God. It's a gracious gift of God to those who have already been delivered. How are we doing? Questions, comments? It's clear. Issues here for you?
You want to dump the small catechism?
No, I don't want to dump the small catechism at all. I think it's very important that as a part of the small catechism, you do in fact get a section of commandments there. That's very fruitful. But I do think it is unfortunate that they're commonly, that they're isolated and presented often apart from the story, or usually apart from the story. And hence can come to be understood as a law code or as an external code, and that's not the biblical way of presenting it.
But isn't that a problem with the catechism in general? I mean, the Lord's Prayer is part. I mean, that's what you did yesterday. That the Lord's Prayer is part of the story.
Yeah.
I think the sacraments are part of us. They are a story.
I think that's so. I'm just saying we ought not do it. It's done. We're never going to stop it from being done. But I think we need to recognize the dangers of isolating this material from their context. What that danger involves.
And I didn't expect that you would.
Let me talk a little bit about obedience. Talk a little bit about obedience. This troublesome word. The law always presupposes an existing relationship with God. I think it's very important that obedience to the law be understood within a context of relationship. Paul has been talking about an authoritative kind of role that God plays within that relationship, and not an authoritarian role. I think commonly when we think of law or God as lawgiver, we think of it in authoritarian terms. The law remains a living, obedience to the law ought to be a living, personal matter. It's a living response within a living relationship. It ought to have a fundamentally personal or relational character to it. It should never focus on obedience as an external observance of a list of rules or whatever of that kind. Obedience is to flow naturally from the life of faith. It's not, you know, a checklist which one carries in one's back pocket and over against which, you know, one checks off this or that during the course of the day. It's a living out of a commitment to a relationship. And let me try an analogy with you. See if it works. I think it breaks down in some ways, but maybe it's helpful. Let me try the image of marriage, and it's not helpful immediately because the relationship between the two parties in the marriage cannot be talked about in terms of obedience, I think, anymore. Though I remember it very much being a part of our. Or did you get it out of there at the last minute?
No, I didn't.
You didn't. It was in there. Okay. But marriage is used in the Old Testament as an analogy to talk about the relationship between God and people. And if one were to work with such an analogy, how would the law function? Well, in the initial stages of the relationship, individuals may not naturally know what it means to live in a relationship of wholeness as a married couple. They may need instruction regarding how to respond in various situations that will best honor the relationship and lead to its realization. Words with regard to honesty and openness, words with regard to being thankful, being gentle, words with regard to the common courtesies, the willingness to compromise, the word be faithful. And in particular situations, one might even become more specific. Help clean the house, help do the dishes, instruction as to what needs to be involved in this relationship. Now, as the relationship matures, certain actions increasingly become a natural response within the relationship. You just begin to do certain things naturally as a part of that relationship. And yet, because people never know everything that they need to know about being in a relationship, they're constantly in need of enlightenment. They're constantly in need of instruction. I think instruction continues to be necessary no matter how mature the relationship. Now, in times of temptation or on bad days, such instruction, no matter how much it may have been internalized and become part of the relationship with the two parties, such instruction can come to the foreground and be there, sort of like a bright light in the night, and can function as a guideline or a limit, which assists in the maintenance and the realization and the building up of that relationship. In the time of temptation, that word, that instruction, may be especially prominent. Be faithful. Now, how does that word function there? The word function, the word functions in that context as limit. Not necessarily as convicting, nothing's happened. Simply limit. And in a sense, it's good news. It's a good word to hear in that kind of situation. And talk about Israel more generally, in marking out sources of temptation, I think it reduces the possibilities for stumbling, for defection, indicates where the pitfalls are. I think the law's function as limit is a very helpful function. Now, when there's a when there's a rupture in the relationship, or one transgresses the limits of a true relationship, then the law comes into function in a different way. It comes into function in a more external way. It can become coercive, so that one has to do something now. One has to. One must do something. Or it can be convicting. It can reveal to one's failures within this relationship. And so depending upon the situation then, the law can function as instruction, can function as limit, guideline, boundary, or it can function to convict individuals. I think what's commonly happened is that we've reduced our understanding of law to just a convicting function. And that's to shortchange its value, and I think the intention which God has for it in its originally being given. One of the things that I think will help point this up is tomorrow, when we get into some particular passages in Deuteronomy with regard to the poor, we're going to see there that the law functions commonly in a way that's different from the way in which it does in a code. And so it's concerned about encouraging and inculcating an attitude, exhorting, admonishing, rather than kind of laying down the law. And we'll see how that functions then tomorrow. It's more a commending approach to obedience than it is a legal approach to obedience. Now, let me raise the question of motive or motivation. Biblical material is very concerned about why people obey. Give me some examples. Why do people obey? Why do you obey?
Personal.
Fear of punishment, okay, that there's something quite negative that will lie on the other side of disobedience. What other reasons might one obey?
Love.
Excuse me?
Love.
Love. Well, talk a little bit more. What do you mean?
Well, if you have a mother or your parent or they ask you to do something, you love and respect them, so
obey. Okay, there's another factor.
To get a good
to get a good. Okay, we put a little flesh on that.
Well, I don't know how to say that. You may act in a certain way in order to get that is
good.
For you.
Okay, good results.
Yeah, okay. I mean, an implied in that may be the opposite, that if you don't do good, you may get something bad, but and there may be the fear of punishment in that, but not necessarily. It's just that to do what is expected may be good.
Okay.
To gain favor?
To gain favor, okay, that might be a particular good. To gain favor with the one to whom one is being obedient.
Trust that someone would know better than I, even if I don't ever exist.
Okay, somebody who knows more about the life situation in which you find yourself, and so you choose to obey because that person knows more about it than you do, and there's kind of trust then that person knows the situation. Yeah.
For order.
For the good order.
The good order. Stop lights.
Yes.
Signs.
Keep order within the community.
To protect other people from.
I think it's all very helpful to get these motivations out. It's interesting now to come back to the biblical text for a few minutes and see how some of these pop in. I think virtually all of them do in one way or another. I think that God gives the law in the first place because it's in the people's own best interests. It's for their good. And we'll come back to that in a moment. But I think the most fundamental motive for Israel's obedience to God is gratitude. And that touches, I think, a couple, love, respect, and so forth, trust, for all that God has done. Listen to Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 20. When your son asks you in time to come, okay, when your child asks you, what in the world are we doing with all these commandments? That's a paraphrase. What's the meaning of the testimonies and the statutes and the ordinance which the Lord our God has commanded you? Okay. Why? Then you shall say to your son, we were Pharaoh's slaves in the land of Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and the Lord showed signs and wonders great and grievous against Egypt and against Pharaoh and all his household before our eyes. And he brought us out from there that he might bring us in and give us the land which he swore to give to our fathers. Okay? Thankfulness to this God for all that he has done, one responds to the law in gratitude. One of the ways in which, particularly the book of Deuteronomy, but also Exodus and other texts, sets this up is with the little word therefore. So if you go to Deuteronomy 4, beginning with verse 37, because God loved your fathers and chose their descendants after them and brought you out of Egypt with his own presence and by his great power and so forth, therefore you shall keep his statutes and his commandments, which I command you this day. One could multiply those upon end. Human conduct, human obedience to what God has to say is a living response to what God has done for the people. The saving deeds of God are what call forth this kind of response. So, gratitude then is sort of maybe the deepest secret of what obedience is all about. There's another way in which one can talk about motivation. And another way is reasonableness. And that didn't pop out in the factors that you listed here, at least in any direct way. But I'm intrigued by the fact that people think that the laws are reasonable. And hence, that's a good reason to obey. In Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, behold, I have taught you statutes and ordinances, as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should do them in the land which you are entering to take possession of it. Keep them and do them, for that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the people. Okay, you're a bee. That will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who, when they hear all these statutes, they will say this: surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. Isn't that an intriguing way of putting it? That any right-thinking person, any person who is wise and understanding, cannot but do otherwise. Outsiders who observe the people obeying the law will remark on how wise and understanding they are. Right obedience is always intelligent obedience. It always is a reasonable character to it. And hence, again and again, when they talk about the law, it doesn't have a kind of authoritarian stamp on it. You know, it's sort of obey the law, period. It gives you some good reasons as to why you ought to do it. It's reasonable, folks. It's the best thing. Now, a related series of motivations are a little bit problematic in this regard. Let me list a couple of them and get you to respond to that in some way. 440 of Deuteronomy. Therefore, you shall keep his statutes and his commandments, which I command you this day, that it may go well with you. Now, here's the good part coming up. That it may go well with you, and with your children after you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which the Lord your God gives you. Why do you obey the law? It'll go well with you, it'll go well with your kids, and you'll live longer. Okay? Well, let's pile on a couple more here. Chapter 6, verse 24. The Lord commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God, for our good always, that he might preserve us alive. Or chapter 11, verse 8 and 9. You shall therefore keep all the commandment which I command you this day, that you may be strong. Okay? That you may be strong. And go in and take possession of the land which you're going to possess, that you may live long in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers to give to them. Now, I think it's important on the one hand to recognize that there's good reason to obey. That's one of the factors involved here. The laws, the materials are not presented naked, without the motivation, constantly being presented there again and again. It's in their own best interest to obey. That's what God intends. Now, what happened to this motivation among us? I think that we have tended to dismiss it. I wonder why. One of the most obvious ways in which it's been dismissed, help me out, some of those of you who are working with confirmation kids, in the fourth commandment, which, what do the kids memorize these days as far as the fourth commandment is concerned? Honor your father and your mother, and that's it, right? How did you memorize it?
That it may go well with you.
Right. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be longer upon the land which the Lord your God gives you. Why is it that the church, or at least some offices in the church, have decided that that last part of that commandment is not fit for the memorization by children? Any idea?
Nursing homes take care of parents.
Okay, nursing homes take care of parents.
I've heard that discussed before, and someone said that it's not actually put that way in Scripture.
No, I think it's right there.
I think so too, but that was the argument then.
Would it be to come away from the reward kind of concept that you could expect life to be long and it might not be?
I think that's what's going on. That's my impression. And as I've talked with a few people about this, they eliminate those clauses, those motivation clauses, because of a concern about reward. That you honor your father and your mother, mixed motives then, because you're going to get a reward in the end.
In this day and age, rewards may be a whole lot different than they were in the past. Also, rewards today are millions of dollars and lots of material things.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's what the text is talking about.
Okay, how's that text work then? Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God gives you. Is that reward language?
But doesn't it say something about their own children taking care of them? Maybe? Carries over
next generation. I'm not certain, Marv, if there's a text someplace that expresses it just like that, not in the list of Ten Commandments. But I think it has nothing to do with rewards in the normal way in which we think about it. That life and well-being are intrinsically related to obedience. That's to say it's to honor your father and your mother. That's the natural result of one who lives in obedience. To live like this will normally, as a matter of course, result in such consequences. Not inevitably, of course. Life is not that consistent. But generally speaking, obedience will lead to a fuller life. I think that's the way that's intended to work. There's a reasonableness factor in there. There's a recognition that God has our best interests at heart. I mean, if you do honor your father and your mother, things are going to go better. Generally speaking, they are. Yeah.
Why was that condition put on that commandment? Why didn't it say, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God gave?
Well, I don't know.
Thou shalt not take the Lord's name in vain. That's a negative one.
But it's
in order that your days might be long.
Now, if they repeated it in every one, it would get a little too much, perhaps. But I thought the book of Deuteronomy repeats it enough so that by the time you come to the end of this book, you've heard it about 50 times. I mean, it's there again and again and again. And you can even get it. Take the passage which I read yesterday about if you chance to come upon a bird's nest. You remember that? What does it say at the end of that? That it may go well with you and that you may live long. You take care of the birds, then it may go well with you and you live long. Well, now, we've only... Really? Well, maybe. Maybe that we were beginning to recognize that our fate has something to do with the fate of the birds. Take care of the birds and maybe it will have some effect upon how long we live and the quality of our life. Maybe they do recognize something here. Yes?
Maybe too there's some hint in that, from my own experience, the marred relationships that hit the deepest and mar my harmony with all of the rest of life are those which are part of family. And when they are not in tune, boy, the rest is hard to get in tune.
That's very
but
nice.
If they are in harmony, it's easier to be in good relations with my neighbor, with my...
You like that? I like that. That's a very nice way of putting its importance in that commandment.
Just do that too.
And now we're teaching all our kids just honor your father and your mother, and we leave off the rest. And forget about it.
Even in medical terms, tension, anxiety, stress, etc., will shorten your lifespan. We've seen that more and more in terms of what that does to our bodies. After all, we're realizing it now with heart disease and other problems.
It's a kind of seamless web to life. And but there are certain relationships that have more profound effects, and the familial ones, in the whole abuse of children these days, we're beginning to see the profound effects that that can have, not simply on the children involved, but the whole society of which we are part. Here.
The trouble with adding that phrase, reconfirmation is that they are so often so concrete, you're saying it's cause and effect. And I know about most confirmation students in most parts of the country, but most of mine have divorced parents, and so they can say, oh, it's because I didn't honor and respect my parents that things are now not going well with me, so it can become a whole, it's all my fault again kind of thing. Instead of seeing it as the whole web of life like we've been talking about.
I think And that's a very important point, Carol. In a given situation, you're going to have to talk about it a little bit more. You're going to have to explain it, okay? You're going to have to work at what this means. You can't just, it's not going to be immediately apparent. But I think it's important. Now, if you extend this, it's kind of interesting. Deuteronomy extends this and it becomes even more problematic. Listen to Deuteronomy 11, verse 13, Paul. If you will obey my commandments, there's another motivation coming out. If you will obey my commandments, which I command you this day, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, he'll give you the rain for your land and its season, the early rain and the later rain, that you may gather in your grain and your wine and your oil, and he'll give grass in your fields for your cattle, that you will eat and be full. You going to go that far? That the obedience of the commandments is going to have that kind of effect? Cosmic effects. That human obedience has cosmic effects.
I have a lot of trouble with that because the United States were abundantly given us great producing land, and I don't think it's because we're keeping our commandments. We're in Africa, they're dying of starvation right and left, and they're probably closer to the truth in there. So, I mean,
when you think of the global situation, we have enough food to feed everyone on the earth right now. It's our distribution and our selfishness that does not allow that.
And is it in fact our lawlessness and selfishness that's in fact contributing more to that situation than the people who are there?
Yeah, oh, definitely. I would agree to that. But it gives this impression that we're being given all this great land because we're keeping the law.
Listen, Hosea chapter 4 puts these things together in a very striking way, I think. Hear the word of the Lord, O people of Israel, for the Lord has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land. There's no faithfulness, there's no kindness, there's no knowledge of God in the land. There's swearing, there's lying, there's killing, there's stealing, there's committing adultery. They break all bounds, and murder follows murder. Therefore, the land mourns. The land mourns! And all who dwell in it languish, and the beasts of the field, and the birds of the air, and even the fish of the sea are taken away. I mean, that sounds like it was written yesterday. And acid rain was in the headline. Human behavior has cosmic effects. Now, you have to be careful in using this material so that you don't kind of have a, you know, have a certain inevitability to it. That the, you know, if they obey the commandments, they're going to get rain, you know, some kind of immediate cause and effect fashion. Now, one needs to move to the negative side of that. We can't talk about this now, but you need to state it negatively, which the commandments do. The Lord your God is a jealous God. How do the commandments end? The Lord your God is a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. Uh-oh. That's the negative side of honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God gives you. I mean, if you kill or steal, it's going to ruin your life. That's what they're saying, in effect. That's putting it at simplest. And it's not a matter of God making a separate judgment in each and every case so that, you know, disaster follows. God's sitting up there, and uh-oh, there's... But again, such results are intrinsic to the act. If God's moral order is such that sinful deeds will have such effects. And if you want to talk about the third and fourth generation, look at our forefathers and foremothers' treatment of the blacks in the mid-19th century and the effects of that down the pike. Look at the abuse of children and the effects of that down into the third and fourth generation. So what it's also talk about the negative effects as well as the positive effects. Let me have a concluding comment here before I can have a few more questions. In the first chapter, in 1 John, chapter 5, makes a statement. By this we know that we love the children of God, when we love God and obey his commandments. By this we know that we love the children of God, when we love God and obey his commands. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. I mean, how do you love God? How do you show love to God? You keep his commandments. And, First John adds, his commandments are not burdensome. One could also go to some interesting statements along the same line in John 14, 15. God really means the law. The law is to be fulfilled. Want to use the language of love? Fine. We'll love our neighbors as ourselves and go so far in that love that there's really no area of life left out. Now, there's a cartoon that has Moses back up on Mount Sinai for about the third time, reporting back to God that 73% are in favor of Commandments 1 to 5, and 41% think that number 6 is unfair, etc. I think this is our inclination when dealing with commandments. I'll deal with some of them or parts of them. And this is the 20th century, after all. Honor my father and my mother. I'm in therapy because of my mother and my father. Adultery. Yeah, that was before birth control. But God really means these things, you know. Now, the law demands the performance of works for the sake of our neighbors, for the sake of our world. You might say, well, I believe in Jesus, and he kept the law, and I don't have to. Not so. Yes, you are no longer under the law for your salvation. But the law is to be fulfilled. And since we don't have to depend upon obedience to the law for our salvation, we can work at it with all our heart. And this is what God asks us to do. And the good news is, of course, that God in Christ has set us free, but he set us free to do something, to do the work that he set out for his people. And our calling and our vocation, this is what God has given us to do, to be about caring, among other things, for the less fortunate among us. It may be hard, it may be demanding, it may be painful, but it's part of the work of the life of faith. We are forgiven sinners, we've been declared righteous, and we've been told to do the law on behalf of our neighbor, which is God's will for our neighbor. Living in the law will shape our life toward the neighbor. Living in the law, when freed from it as a self-saving device, will turn us away from ourselves toward others. It's amazing how common these laws, we'll see tomorrow, are always pushing you outside of yourself toward others. There's a sense in which we can say that we're baptized into the commandments, not to be saved by them, but to do them on behalf of others. Now, we come back and also say that obeying the law is never enough. We always have to go beyond the law. The laws are never static. That's what we talked about yesterday. And we'll also want to talk some about law as imitation of God. That's tomorrow. But comments, questions here in the last few minutes we have, Mark?
I think there's a tendency of people to resist this push outside of themselves. In my town, a guy was run down as he crossed the street to go to the Assembly of God Church. The guy driving the car was half blind, and the people in this man's family, that they were refusing to press charges because they claimed they were Christians and that wasn't appropriate. The policeman who talked to me about it were really upset with that. We're wondering, is that what it means to be a Christian? You know, it isn't just the liberals that are afraid of the law and using it.
This is really, really helpful for me because I've heard a tremendous amount of obedience to the law. What I was hearing was trusting God. I never quite thought about that one before. That was really an interesting viewpoint.
Good. Appreciate it. Yes?
One of the emphases that my pastor's father has repeated over the years, but after a while it sinks in, is the fact that in the New Testament, God, if Jesus calls us to love,
But he also calls it the discipleship, which is right back into obedience, and a disciplined, obedient life. And we want to do all the love stuff and personal relationship stuff, but we want to avoid the call to be discipleship.
Helpful. I think the discipleship language is another way in which we can talk about many of these same things.
Yes. Would these commandments be, when they were given, were they thought of as being commandments for the whole people? The promises would be for the whole people rather than specific individuals. You know, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, everybody, rather than just Jehoiakim and a few individuals. And in that way, God will bless the whole people. Then, you know, if they keep the law and are obedient, then the sons and the showers will come at the right time and they'll prosper. Doesn't the problem arise when you single that out and make one man righteous and the sun and the rains will fall on him as a just reward? I'm trying to think about how would it be if the farmers in Nebraska and the farmers in Georgia came together and talked about righteousness and obedience to the law. The poor people in Georgia are suffering because they're not as obedient as the good people in Nebraska.
I think you can't factor things out. A comparable question earlier today with regard to Paul, you simply can't factor things out that way. I think you do need to say generally that obedience makes a difference, not simply at the interhuman level, but it has cosmic effects. But there are so many, the causal weave of which Paul has spoken is so complex and so varied that there's many different causal factors that feed into any given situation. I can't figure that all out. But coming back to the question about the legal materials, most of the materials are intended for the people of God. There are some legal materials that are intended for all of human time. So that we'll see in the prophets, for example, in Amos will go after non-Israelites for disobedience of law. There are certain materials, particularly in Leviticus, that are intended only for the priests. So there are some divisions there like that. Well, thank you very much for today. Tomorrow, does God prefer the poor?